Well, sorry about the blip that happened there, but I hope most people have found their way back. I can see most people have.
I switch so that you can see them.
Now, first thing I'd like to say is this is a very special time. Very special time of year for a number of reasons. Of course, not the least of which it's spring. We can be outside, we can enjoy the birds. It's also, of course, a sacred time in a number of traditions, right? Last weekend was Passover, also Palm Sunday. This weekend, of course, is the celebration of Easter. And then, you know, next week, I think on Monday or Tuesday, is the beginning of Ramadan. So there's a lot of forces coming together at this time. But it's also, I think, an important time because in our grappling with the pandemic, I think we're realizing that there may be an end in sight at last. And it's not that things will return to the way they were, but I think if we can bring forward our own practice into the world, we'll find a new place, not starting over, not back to where we were, but somewhere new, fresh, beginning fresh again. Well, this morning what I'd like to talk about is a koan from the Mumong Kan, which is a collection, number 39. Now, the Mumong Kan, or in English it's called the Gateless Gate, is one of the most important collections of these koans or Zen stories, Zen dialogues in our own tradition. And the particular story, the particular koan I selected, I'll first admit I did this by divination, kind of a book divination, which is I kind of pick up the book, flip through it, and stopped at somewhere and thought, okay, I guess I'll make this one the koan that I'll talk about on Sunday. If it speaks to me at all, otherwise I flip through the book again and wait and try to get another one. I don't know if that's legal, but anyway, that's what I do. So let's begin with the koan itself, which includes what's called a case, which is usually the short dialogue or the main story, a commentary by Mumon, who was the monk who compiled this, and that's called Mumong Kan. Kan kind of means like a collection by Mumon, who's the person. And his name actually means the gateless gate. So actually Kan actually means barrier, so a gateless barrier kind of thing. So and then it also includes a poem by Mumon. So let's begin. So a monk speaking to Yunmen began quoting now, "The radiance serenely illuminates the whole vast universe." Before he could finish, Yunmen abruptly interrupted him and said, "Aren't you quoting Zhangzhou?" And the monk replied, "Yes, yes, I am." And Yunmen shouted, "You're off track." And later, Zen master Shishen brought this up. "Tell me," he said to his students, "where did the monk get off track?" Mumon's kind of comment on this little dialogue. If you recognize Yunmen's particular skillfulness, you will know at what point the student was off track. And you will be a teacher of humans and devas. If not, you cannot even recognize yourself. And then finally, the poem. A line is cast into the swift flowing stream. Rising for the bait, you are hooked. When the seam of your mouth opens even a little, your life is completely lost. So these koan in general, these stories and verses and dialogues, they present the fundamental perspectives on life. They talk about the nature of self, the relationship of self to the whole world, the interbeing of Buddha nature in all things. And there's a lot we could say about these, the history of these koans, the structure of them, development of them. But we can leave that for another time. That's not really important for today. For us at this moment, the most important thing I think to keep in mind is that these stories are passed down from generation to generation to evoke and illuminate the basic nature of who we are. That's their purpose. So when we engage with a koan, you may ask, what is it telling me about me? What is it telling me about me? One Zen teacher, a kind of a more contemporary Zen teacher, said this about koans. He wrote, "They are the clearest possible expression of perennial facts, which students grasp with focused mind and guidance." I think each koan, each of these stories, offers a number of dharma gates, a number of windows into the human condition. But they're not easy to kind of penetrate because they're mostly from classical China. Anyway, today let's look at the one that Mumon Kan number 39, this classical koan, see what it may offer us in understanding ourselves and understanding others. And the traditional way, which we'll do, is considering the characters who appear in the koan. And the main character, of course, is Yunmen. Now, Yunmen is very famous, and maybe you've come across him before if you're listening to other talks. He's one of the last teachers of the Buddha Way that appeared during the Tang Dynasty, the so-called golden age of Zen in China. So the Tang Dynasty lasted from roughly 7th century through to the 10th century. And it's considered actually to be kind of the highlight of Chinese civilization by all kinds of historians. Because not only was the civilization highly developed and sophisticated, it was also very cosmopolitan. The capital, Chang'an, which is a little bit more in the center of China, welcomed people and traders from all over the world. There are people from the Middle East, people from Europe, from Russia, those places that those names that we use now, Persia, Japan, Korea, had all come and they lived and interacted together in Chang'an. So Yunmen lived at the end of this particular prosperous time, the Tang Dynasty. But at the end, of course, was a time of great turmoil and chaos, because the dynasty was kind of crumbling. The information we have about Yunmen, this great teacher, is really quite extensive, because his sayings, his speech was recorded very soon after his death, and so historians consider it fairly accurate, things that he said and did. And we have lots of anecdotes about his encounters with his own teachers and with his students, some of them collected in things like the Momonkan that we're looking at today. It said he had over 60 disciples who themselves became great teachers. So, as you can see, he's greatly admired as one of the key, most important teachers in the Zen tradition. He's also noted, though, for using a great number of techniques to awaken his students. He would give one-word answers, he would pose questions, and then answer them on the student's behalf. And of course, he would sometimes call out the sayings of the masters who came before him, the Zen teachers that came before him, and he was not above chasing his monks, his students, out of the room with his staff and giving them the occasional whack as well. So he had a lot of tools in his tool belt. But let me just give you a couple of examples of the kind of dialogues that we have left by him. Very short, they're just like two sentences long each. So a monk asked, "What is the straight path to Yunmen Mountain? What's the straight path to you?" And Yunmen replied, "Intimacy." A monk asked Yunmen, "What is Buddha?" And Yunmen replied, "Dried shit stick." That's a very famous one. You've probably heard that one before. But Yunmen not only pushed and really shocked his students, he also instructed them, I think, with a kind of kindness. So here's the last little dialogue I want to give you. Once Yunmen ascended the teaching seat and said to the assembly, "Each and every person embodies radiant light. If you try to see it, it's totally hidden. Then what is each and every person's radiant light?" No one in the assembly could answer. A Yunmen answered for them. "The monk's hall, the Buddha hall, the kitchen, the monastery gate." Well, we could have a Dharma talk about that little dialogue too, but maybe that's enough about Yunmen for the moment. Let's return to the actual case, number 39. But please keep in mind, the last quote, this last little story of Yunmen that I read to you, "Each and every person embodies radiant light. If you try to see it, it's totally hidden." Then what is each and every person's radiant light? Now, as for the monk that appears in the case, the koan that we just looked at, we don't know anything about him. But for some reason, he stands up and he begins to recite a very famous poem, which I'll come back to in a moment, to Yunmen. And before he's gotten very far, Yunmen abruptly cuts him off, saying, "Aren't those the words of Zhangzhou?" Now, Zhangzhou was a low-level scholar in ancient China, meaning that he had passed the first level of the civil service exam, giving him and his family a certain level of prestige. Having passed the civil service exam, Zhangzhou received a position, low-level, but still a position in the Chinese bureaucracy, which exempted him and his family from paying taxes, from any kind of physical punishment should they do any kind of criminal action. There can be no physical punishment given to them, and other kind of benefits as well. So it was very important to get into the bureaucracy in China at that time. However, as a young man, this Zhangzhou became very interested in Buddhist practice and spent much of his time meeting and talking and practicing with teachers in the Zen or the Chan tradition. And at one point, Zhangzhou experienced a very profound, very deep insight, and he wrote a poem. And this poem became well known and very well respected within the Chan or Zen Buddhist circles. Practitioners, both lay and ordained, would memorize this poem and recite it. So here's just a few more lines from that poem. It's a little bit too long for us to look at in depth, but here's a couple more lines from it just to give you a more of a flavor. It goes like this. The radiance serenely illuminates the whole universe. The ignorant, the wise, all beings are in my abode. To cut off fixations is to increase your illness. To aspire to the truth itself is in error. Nirvana, birth and death. Just flowers in the sky. Isn't that beautiful? Just flowers in the sky. Anyway, it's a bit longer poem. But the koan, as I said, doesn't explain the situation. Did Yuman ask the monk to speak? Was the monk kind of just standing up to begin with a question and started off with a poem? It's interesting, though, that the poem that this monk began to recite echoes Yunmen's own words, right? Each and every person embodies radiant light. If you try to see it, it's totally hidden. Then what is each and every person's radiant light? Right? Remember the first line of the poem is, the radiant light serenely illuminates the whole universe. So perhaps this monk, and I suspect it was a young monk, but maybe I'm wrong, was trying to impress Yunmen or others in the assembly in some way. I've memorized this poem, I'll recite it. Or, Yunmen always talking about radiance, so here we go. Yunmen sensed something was not quite right and abruptly and rudely objected. Now, when I first read this poem, and maybe you too, I thought maybe the issue was one of quotation. You know, the monk was not speaking his own words. Perhaps Yunmen is criticizing this monk for quoting a well-known poem about awakening and suchness or Buddha nature because they're not his own words. And so he tells the monk, you're off track. And while that may be true, I really don't think that's the case. Zen teachers from ancient times frequently quoted one another, usually without reference, since the quotes were often very well known, no need to say who said it. And Dogen, the Japanese monk who brought our school of Zen practice from China to Japan in the 1200s, and today recognizes one of Japan's greatest philosophers. In all his writings, which are quite extensive, peppered throughout are quotations and phrases that come from earlier teachers, and most of them have no reference at all. So Dogen too indulged in this. This was simply the practice. Quotation is not the issue for Yunmen. The problem lies in how authentic or genuine the quoted poem was for the monk, I think. I should say, you know, I was thinking, if Dogen handed in one of his essays at university today, he'd probably be expelled for plagiarism. Anyway, back to the thing. Yunmen senses something is not quite right or quite true in the monk's voice, and so he interrupts him. Hey, are you quoting Zhangzhou? And the monk simply, perhaps meekly, replies, yes. And I think with that yes, it becomes clear the monk is not speaking from his own truth, that he was parroting rather than offering something from his own true being. Yunmen evidently could see the monk had not made the poem his own. It was something he had memorized. That's all. He was off track. So I was thinking about this. What does it mean to make words your own? What does it mean to make thoughts even your own? I think this is a really vital issue for us today. Over the past 2 years or more, we have all seen the destructive and divisive views promoted in social media and swallowed whole by so many people. Conspiracy theories abound. And while we may laugh at the more kind of radical or outrageous ones, there are many who embrace them. And research shows that by accepting a conspiracy theory, that can help people to feel that they are part of something larger than themselves, giving them a reason for the chaos of their life, and providing them with a tribe to belong to, among other things. Yunmen calls out to the monk, telling him, "You're off track," and in that voice telling him to return to upright speech, upright thought, to speak. Yes, speak, we do need to speak, but speak from your own experience and truth. Get back on track. Conspiracy theories are an extreme example, perhaps. But what about our everyday assumptions, judgments, our everyday views, expectations, opinions about ourselves, about others, about the government, about the world? Are they on track? Do they come from our own considered experience, our own understanding and truth? Do our speech and actions arise from our deeply grounded place? And do we pause before speaking? Maybe do we pause and investigate to make sure, yeah, this is my truth. This is really my opinion, my view. It's not just something that I've adopted or parroted so that we can make an impression, so that I belong to a tribe. I don't think this is easy. The Buddha encouraged all his followers to investigate and know for themselves. We see this over and over again in the early writings, and particularly in the Kalama Sutta, one of the earliest Buddhist texts. In this sutta, in this text, the Buddha visits a community known as the Kalama, and they ask him how to know the truth from falsehood, because they keep getting all these gurus coming into the village, telling them this and telling them that, and there's often a lot of conflict there. And the Buddha replied this, "Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon bias toward a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon seeming ability, nor upon the consideration the monk is our teacher." None of that. Maybe you could add, nor upon reading it in social media. Don't accept it. When you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, enter there and abide there. I think you kind of get what I'm aiming at here when I ask, what does it mean to make words your own? If the monk had indeed made the poem his own, how might he have answered Yunmen's challenge? What do you think? Perhaps, this is my 2 cents worth, the monk may have replied, "Why do you assign names to words?" Or, "What's the difference between Zhangzhou's mouth and mine?" I ask you, standing in that monk's place, how would you respond? I Another pointer here, or aspect of this koan, I think, is Yunmen's interruption. He stops the monk. And perhaps you, like me, get annoyed or frustrated when interrupted. Hey, I was saying something important, something for your benefit, something wise, something thoughtful, something funny, something that makes me look good, something. And suddenly an interruption arises. We notice that, I think, mostly in conversation, or when we're intent on a particular task. But I suggest this. When we are grounded and aware, perhaps we notice interruptions in the flow of our life. The world interrupts us. The world interrupts us. The future, whether immediate or distant, seldom unfolds as planned, right? The maps and plans made for the day or for the week or for the year or for the life need to be constantly redrawn, rewritten. Interruption and change are essential characteristics of reality. Over and over again, we lose our imagined path, and we need to start again. Dogen wrote in the Shobo Genzo, his main work, in a chapter called Awesome Presence of Active Buddhas. He wrote this: stepping forward is a mistake. Stepping backward is also a mistake. Taking one step is a mistake. Taking two steps, also a mistake. Therefore, one mistake after another mistake. He's talking about our life. In the same light, we could characterize our life as one interruption after another. The phone rings, the store is closed, your partner interrupts the murder mystery you're reading, a car suddenly slams into yours, the doctor gives you bad news, a pandemic happens. Interruption after interruption after interruption. Your life's small and grand plans derailed, and derailed again, and derailed again. But that's just life. How do you respond? Facing the interruption, do you try to go back before the interruption? Do you start afresh? Do you hold on to your carefully imagined way things should be? Or do you meet each moment fresh? Do you greet the interruption? Or does the interruption blindside you? Interruption is not the problem. It is, after all, just reality being reality. But how you respond can be a problem. We make it a problem. So the last line of the case reads, just to go back, because later Zen master Shishin brought this up. Tell me, he said to his own students, where did the monk go get off track? I really appreciate this last little bit at the end, because I think even though Shishin lived about 200 years after Yunmen, so he's tacking this on to the koan 200 years later, it made the koan alive for his students. And I think it makes it alive for us too. He asks each of us to speak. Where did the monk get off track? And perhaps if he were here, if he was facing you, he would ask, where do you go off track? Finally, the poem. A line is cast onto the swift flowing stream, rising for the bait you are hooked. When the seam of your mouth opens even a little, your life is completely lost. Lovely little poem, I think. We live in this swift flowing stream of pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. And how easily it is to get hooked, wanting this, pushing away that. As long as we are alive, baited hooks cry out for our attention. And isn't it true that most of the time we swallow the bait? I want that praise. I like that praise. I don't want that blame. Take away the pain, give me some pleasure. Don't besmirch my reputation. Let me be called a hero, etc., etc. We swallow the bait. Being who we are, conditioned as we are, we can't help swallowing the bait over and over again, I think. And our practice is not to keep our mouth shut, because, first of all, I don't think that'd be possible. But I think our practice is to see the bait as bait and let go over and over again. Over and over again, we realize, oh, I swallowed that. Spit it out. Begin again. Yes, it is true. Swallowing the bait, our life is completely lost. That last line of the poem, right? Your life is completely lost. I think that's true. But moment after moment, we are reborn. And we continue our life in that swift flowing stream. And that's all right. Because we are carried and we are upheld by our bodhisattva vows. And these vows sustain us when we fall for the bait. But I think their greatest gift to us, these vows that we hold, these vows open our awareness to the other swish, the other fish swallowing the bait. And out of that awareness, our compassion arises and flows. And the intention to continue and deepen our practice becomes not only for our own sake, but for the sake of all. And that becomes our foundation. So, I would add this to the poem. A line is cast into the swift flowing stream, rising for the bait, you're hooked. When the seam of your mouth opens even a little, your life is completely lost. Born again and again, we awaken to the fish all around, and we make our vows to save them. Thank you for listening.